From the Danker Studio on Library Square, this is The Rundown, an exploration of local news, current events, and issues that matter to you. Today on the program, we're going to be having a conversation with University of Utah computer scientist Mariah Meyer. Dr. Meyer is a pioneer in the field of data visualization, which works to help scientists make use of large quantities of complex data to help propel research and bring about new insights.
We look for things we expect, but it's that unexpected that visualization is really good at sometimes pulling out and making people aware of, where you say, oh yeah, that looks about right, but gosh, what is that outlier doing? Why is that there? And I think that's really sort of the power of visualization, is to show you things you weren't expecting to see.
Translating complicated information into meaningful imagery, plus your summary of the day's top local headlines, just ahead on The Rundown here on KCPW. And thanks again for tuning into The Rundown. I'm Roger McDonough. Coming up later in the show, we're going to have part one of a conversation with a University of Utah computer scientist about creating visualizations to help pull meaning out of large quantities of data. And these aren't just your average charts and graphs. First up, though, we have a look at a library of sound. Thousands of animal and ambient sounds from 11 Western states have been recorded and archived in a digital library in Utah. While fascinating in their own right, sounds can also be used to track environmental change. Kim Shusky of Explore Utah Science has that story.
Some people like to hunt animals, not to kill them, but to record the sounds they make. Conservationists, scientists, volunteers, and state and federal agency employees have contributed over 2,600 animal sounds that are now housed at the biggest library of its kind in the West, called the Western Soundscape Archive. The project was founded by recording engineer Jeff Rice and digital librarian Kenning Arledge in order to document the sounds of animals living in the West and to make people aware so they will want to protect the environment where these animals live. The Digital Sound Archive is kept at the University of Utah's Marriott Library. Anna Nietrauer helped develop the archive.
The Western Soundscape Archive is a site that collects animal sounds centered on 11 states in the American West, and it provides a really good overview of all the species that live in our states, as well as also ambient sounds for national parks, quite a variety of sounds that people can listen to from their computers.
Nietrauer says archiving animal sounds is important because when people think about environmental issues and declining landscapes, they usually think about the visual aspects.
The sounds associated with these natural landscapes change as well. So preserving that now for the future is very useful.
But recording the sounds is not always easy. Many animals are active early in the morning and can be in hard-to-reach locations. Different microphones are needed for different jobs. By using a parabolic microphone, it's possible to pick up weak sounds from a few meters away, while a small remote microphone can be dropped into burrows in the ground or holes in a tree. But some sound enthusiasts go even further, says Nietrauer.
If you search the archive for ant interview, you can hear a story of a scientist describe how he recorded the vibrations that ants make by holding them between his teeth. It shows just how devoted people are for capturing these sounds.
The recordings include over 500 bird species, 300 mammals, dozens of snakes, turtles, lizards, and frogs, as well as multiple insects. Many of the recordings are paired with predicted species distribution maps and pictures of the animals, which can be found by common or scientific name.
We have some sounds from animals that you think would not make sounds, like earthworms, for example. And in that case, the sound for that sound clip, it's more like the dirt falling as the earthworm moves through the ground.
The individual animal sounds are important, but so are collections of sounds from particular landscapes. These collections, or soundscapes, include sounds of animals, geophysical features such as wind and streams, and human-produced sounds collected over the course of a day from different locations in the natural world. Soundscapes are frequently represented visually as spectrograms. The images of daily acoustic patterns can be used to better understand the area's biodiversity and health. Donated by the National Park Service, there are over 10,000 spectral images from 24 national parks in the Western Soundscape Archive.
And you can actually look at these sound wave graphs and pinpoint things like airplane flights going overhead and disrupting the landscape versus, you know, variations in the ambient noise that you might get in different seasons. So that's something that can appeal more if people are doing research in that area.
Scientists are realizing that the auditory environment is as important as the visual landscape in understanding the health of an ecosystem. And the National Park Service is actively searching for ways to better protect the natural environment from the impacts of human sound, since studies suggest the acoustical environment is important for animals to find mates, protect their young, and to communicate about territories. So the next time you're out in nature, remember to listen as well as look. To learn more and find links to sounds in this story, go to exploreutahscience.org. For KCBW and Explore Utah Science, I'm Kim Shusky.
And now on The Rundown, we're speaking with Mariah Meyer, a computer scientist at the University of Utah who's having an impact on the way researchers look at data. Dr. Meyer is a pioneer in the relatively new field of visualization, which uses graphic computer representations to help scientists envision, manage, and interact with large quantities of data in ways that would otherwise be impossible. Before coming to Utah, she was a postdoctoral research fellow at Harvard University. She was awarded a Microsoft Research Faculty Fellowship in 2012 and has been listed among the magazine Fast Company's list of the 100 most creative people. Dr. Meyer, your list of accolades go on. You're a 2013 TED Fellow, for example. But for the sake of time, I'll just say thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
So it dawns on me that it might be tough to do a radio interview about visualization, but maybe you can describe for us a little the history of the field of visualization, maybe the methodology of translating data into meaningful graphic imagery. And actually, maybe in your own words, you could just tell us what visualization is.
Sure. Yeah, talking about something that's inherently visual in a sound medium is always challenging. But visualization, at least the kind of visualization I do, is about taking data, and this is usually complex, large amounts of data, and turning it into some sort of interactive visual representation so that people can explore it and people can make sense of it in a way that if you just had to look at it in, say, an Excel spreadsheet, would be absolutely impossible. You would be overwhelmed with numbers. So this is about, in a simple case, this would be about turning, you know, a column of data into a bar chart or a pie chart. But in more complex representations, when you have many columns and many data points, more complex things like graphs or circles with lines connecting in order to represent inherent relationships that are in the data.
And you know, how much is this about? I think about those Excel, you know, pie charts or you know, graphs that are just very simple visualizations. But a lot of what you do is actually design work when you think about it, right? Finding novel ways or ways that provide insight to people who are doing this research. How much of it is about design itself?
Yeah, I think a whole lot of it. I'd say most of it. One of the things about visualization that I think maybe people don't always necessarily understand right away is that the act of creating those images, even if they are interactive and you have to program it, is a very small portion of what we do. A lot of what we do is spending time trying to understand what is it that someone actually needs to do? What are the relationships between the different parts of the data that are going to be most informative for specific questions they have? I often talk about this part of the work that I do as sort of data counseling, where I go and I talk to these scientists who are completely overwhelmed and in this deep, dark place because they can't make sense of their data. And you talk to them and they're like, I don't know, I need help. And so I feel like my role is often as the data counselor is to help move them towards being able to express what it is it really deeply that they need to be able to do to make the scientific question more apparent to them. And so helping them articulate that and then using that articulation to guide the design process that we go through in picking good visual representations that match the needs that they have.
We kind of mentioned this before the interview started, that as a reporter and host here, I've had this experience of interacting with people. And you know, I feel like it's a privilege to get to talk to people and kind of on the surface, you know, dig into what they're doing and learn a little bit. But what you do, one day you have to be a molecular biologist and the next day you have to be a quantum physicist. I mean, you really have to dig in to get a deep understanding of their. If you're going to create or help them understand their data, you really have to understand their data as well. I say data, you say data. It's just how we are.
I probably say tomato and you say tomato.
Maybe so, yeah.
No, but that is absolutely, that is probably why I do what I do, is I feel like I have this really awesome, I'm in this awesome position where I get to just go off and spend my days talking to people who are at the cutting edge of their field. They spent their entire career learning about this thing, and I just get to sit down and they tell me about all the really cool stuff that they do. And then through computer science and through visualization, I then get to be part of that scientific process by creating tools that enable them to do their science more efficiently or in ways they couldn't before. And that's the part that motivates me. And it was actually, I had this experience while I was working on my PhD where I got this summer internship as a science writer at the Chicago Tribune. Mm. And I oftentimes reflect back on that summer as a science writer. That was the first time I was in this situation where every week I had to go off and learn about some totally new field that I knew nothing about, and then somehow translate that into a compelling story that was understandable by the general public. And when I started with my postdoc and I found myself in Boston talking to biologists, and turned out I knew nothing about biology, I often felt like I was back in that newsroom setting where I had to come up with questions to understand what it is that, you know, they were trying to tell me but couldn't quite articulate, and do that translation, only this time that translation into visual representations. And it just felt so much like being a science journalist. And I think that was the hook for me that got me really passionate about the work I'm doing now.
But you talk about translation, and it's not necessarily that you're translating their data for the rest of us or even for other researchers, but you're kind of translating their data for them, I mean, for these researchers themselves, so that they can, you're providing them a platform for having the maybe insight, but also ability to analyze their data better.
Right, exactly. Yes, and that's definitely a distinction. Now, I should say that there's some people in the viz community, in the visualization community, who do very much focus on creating visualizations for a more broad audience. And there I would say that translation analogy would really be the same. My work is about creating tools for analysts and for domain experts to do their work. But again, it constantly surprises me, you know, like, In any field that you're in, you're really good at this thing you do, and it's really hard when you're stuck in those details to be able to step back and see sometimes a bigger picture in a different way. And I feel like as a computer scientist in particular, what I often bring to my collaborations with these scientists is an ability to sort of step back, to generalize, to think about things in a sort of different, more algorithmic perspective. And it's really interesting how oftentimes just that perspective change can lead the scientists to start thinking about their data or thinking about their scientific questions in a new and interesting way and lead them down totally new paths.
Can you give me an example of an occasion where that, where like maybe creating a new kind of visualization has helped a scientist that you've worked with gain a special insight that they might not have necessarily had were it not for this kind of work?
Sure, yeah. Pretty tangible example, I think, would be one tool that I was working with some biologists back in Boston, and we created some new ways to look at this data. They'd been looking at this data using traditional methods for a while, and myself and some colleagues created some new representations. And when we first showed these representations to them, the first thing that they did, which is quite common, is they look for things that they already knew about in their data to sort of validate that these new representations were actually effective, and also that we basically got it right too.
Okay.
And so they were looking at a couple of data points that they knew a lot about, and they were like, oh yeah, you see this pattern, great, yeah, that's something we knew about, we can see it here, it's really obvious, wonderful. But then they started looking deeper, and in this one set of data that they had been looking at for several years now, there was one specific data point that didn't follow this pattern that they had been expecting it to. And they just sort of stepped back and they're like, wait, what's that? Is that a problem in our data? They went back and checked, and no. And what this did is this led them to start brainstorming and hypothesizing about, well, why would, for this one data point, why would this pattern be different? They ended up doing follow-up experiments in the research lab to try to understand this and discovered, in this case, an unknown gene duplication event for this one species of yeast that they were studying. So, and I think that's oftentimes a success story for visualization, is we look for things we expect, but it's that unexpected that visualization is really good at sometimes pulling out and making people aware of, where you say, oh yeah, that looks about right, but gosh, what is that outlier doing?
Yeah.
Why is that there? And I think that's really sort of the power of visualization, is to show you things you weren't expecting to see.
So if data is presented in certain ways, is it more likely to allow for that kind of insight?
Well, and I think this gets back to your question about the design aspect in the visualization process. One of the things I believe strongly in, and I find is often hard for the students that I teach to wrap their heads around, is the fact that there is no right answer. There is no one way that this thing should be represented or that this thing should be visualized. That's where you sort of have to put on your design hat and you have to say, okay, here's the space of possibilities of the ways that I could imagine representing this kind of data. Here are the pros and cons of each one of those ways. And based on those constraints, what kind of decision am I going to make and why? And oftentimes what we do is we'll show, you know, we'll create visualizations of multiple different representations and show those to our collaborators in order to get feedback to help to bring them into the process to help us decide, you know, what would be of the set of options the best thing for them for doing the kind of work that they want to do. One of the things I think is really interesting is that I believe strongly that when I look at a visualization that I've created for, you know, a biologist or for a poet or something, you know, I see words or I see little time series or something, but they see something totally different because what they bring to the table is an enormous amount of domain knowledge. So, you know, their brains are just layering on all sorts of additional information that they, you know, just knowledge that they have in their head. And they're making all sorts of connections that aren't in that data set, but that data set and that visualization is enabling them to do.
Wow. So in the end, it becomes much more meaningful probably to them than it would be to you, the creator of the visualization.
I would say most certainly. And I think that's why it's so important to do these sorts of collaborations where we bring the scientists and the domain experts in as part of that design cycle and as part of this sort of feedback iterative prototyping loop. Because I'm not going to go off and spend 20 years learning biology just so I can create one tool.
Right. You know, in your in a TED talk that you gave, you say that sometimes statistical models can strip away the richness of data. And I'm wondering if you could give us an example of what you mean by that.
My favorite example to give, because I think it sort of resonates with a lot of people, well, and as a professor, I care about this stuff now, is the U.S. News and World Report college rankings. So, you know, every year they publish, you know, a ranked ordered list of schools, and every year, you know, people worry about where their school falls out. But the way that they come up with this ranking is that they collect tons and tons and tons of data about colleges and universities all across the U.S. It's everything from tuition rates to rates of graduation to student-to-teacher ratios, test scores of incoming freshmen, and so on. So tons and tons of data go into this, basically the statistical model that U.S. News and World Report has created that takes all this data, munges it, and decides, okay, this year Harvard is number one, and MIT is number two, and University of Utah is whatever. So what we see is this ranked ordered list of schools, which is great because wrapping your head around this huge, huge data set would take, I don't know how long to make, you know, make a decision. But by just putting schools in this ranking, you know, it could be that, you know, one of the things that's really important for you is a really strong communications department. One of the things that's really important for me is a strong engineering department. But that gets completely washed out in this individual ranking.
In the statistical model. And so you have just like, this is numerical one through whatever, and it's all you're thinking about is that point.
Exactly. You take something as complex and diverse and rich as a university, and you give it a single number.
You know, I'm wondering if there are instances in which visualization might get in the way of insight.
Yeah, I think that there are ways to characterize problems that can, to some degree, tell whether or not a visualization is a good sort of tool to use versus maybe something like a statistical model. And I think there's situations where the questions are really well defined and all the data really exists out there, that just being able to write an algorithm or write a statistical model that says, what is the answer? And of course, the answer is always 42. But what's the answer to this question? And so there's certainly situations where visualization is overkill. I would argue, though, at least in my experience and people I've talked with, that it's rare that, especially in science, that people's questions are incredibly, incredibly well-formed, especially as science moves more and more into this sort of data-driven aspect where people are now just, because we can, measuring everything and saying, right, we're going to go off, we're going to measure everything, and then we're just going to see what's in it. And in that situation, I think it's, again, you're looking for the unexpected. And I think in that case, you need need a way to get in, to make sense. You need this sort of canvas so that you can bring your domain knowledge to the table as well and put all that together in a way that makes sense. And visualization, I think, is a really great tool. It's not the only way, but it's a great way to do that.
Was University of Utah computer science professor Mariah Meyer. We'll feature the second half of this conversation on the program tomorrow. I'm Roger McDonough, and you're listening to The Rundown. Stay with us. And thanks again for tuning into The Rundown. That's all the time we have today. Our program was produced by Lauren Colucci. We had additional help from Jesse Ellis and Mr. Tyler Ford. Our theme music was composed by Tim Myers. Tomorrow on the program, we'll have part two of our conversation with Mariah Meyer about finding unique ways to represent large amounts of information visually. Roger McDonough, thanks for listening. The Utah Business Report and Marketplace are coming up next.